Now we come to our Bible study. And when you get your program card, you will find that we are beginning today a new series on Sunday morning, four addresses leading up to May the 1st, which may be Labor Day in more senses than one this year. We're going to entitle this series of four studies, Why Politicians Are Bound to Disappoint Us. And it's a study in the early history of the monarchy of Israel. That story is contained for us in the book of 1 Samuel, and we're going to survey several chapters of that book, 1 Samuel, this morning for our Bible study. I'd like you to turn to chapter 15 of 1 Samuel for our Bible reading right now. The first king of Israel was named Saul. And this is a crucial incident in his life. Samuel said to Saul, "I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them, put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men from Judah. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, "Go away, leave the Amalekites, so that I do not destroy you along with them, for you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites moved away from the Amalekites. Then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur, to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag, and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves and the lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, "Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone down to Gilgal." When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." "Stop," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night."
"Tell me,"
Saul replied. Samuel said, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying, 'Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you have wiped them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?"
"But I did obey the Lord," Saul said. "I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal."
But Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. It all began in ancient Greece. Athens, to be precise. It was they who invented the word for it. Demokratia, rule by the people. Not that we would have recognized Athenian society as particularly democratic by our 20th century standards. Neither women nor slaves had any political rights at all there. And one senses that since they probably constituted over 90% of the adult population, it was hardly what we would call majority rule. What's more, if some Chartist or suffragette had arisen demanding universal franchise, I suspect they would have quickly followed Socrates to the bowl of hemlock. Greek democracy was every bit as oppressive in its way as any of the aristocracies of Europe have ever been. For it wasn't our modern theory of egalitarianism that motivated the Greeks. No, it was something far more pragmatic. A very profound suspicion of dictatorship. The Greeks, the Athenians, had seen tyranny firsthand, both in the Persian Empire and in their own early history, and they did not like it. They were determined to rule it out. So with characteristic Greek originality, they derived this novel political idea. A system which, as Pericles, in an ancient speech attributed to him, points out, was completely without precedent in the ancient world. Our constitution doesn't copy the laws of neighboring states, he says. We are a pattern for others rather than imitators ourselves. Our administration favors the many instead of the few. This is why it is called democracy. And of course, even now, 2.5 millennia later, Pericles' claim is still true. That Athenian system, albeit much modified, is still a model which excites the admiration of the world. Of course, again, to be strictly accurate, what the Greeks meant by the word democracy and what we mean by it is rather different. Democracy for them meant, quite literally, government by the people, participation in the executive decisions of government on the part of every Greek adult male. Such a system, of course, would be hopelessly impractical in a modern state numbering millions, such as we have. So for us, democracy has come to mean representation. Government not so much by the people as for the people. We choose our leaders by popular vote, and they govern on our behalf. That's how we understand the word. And therein perhaps lies the reason that we are somewhat less satisfied with the results of our political system than the Greeks were with theirs. For of course, even if it is a democratic process that selects who those leaders will be, even if accountability to the people prevents those leaders from turning into the worst possible kinds of tyrants, elected leaders can still disappoint us. In fact, experience seems to indicate that they do so with monotonous regularity. Whoever wins the general election on May the 1st, however great the majority he obtains at the ballot box turns out to be, I guarantee you this, that in less than 12 months, the opinion polls will be showing that his popularity has taken a dive. The story is always the same in that respect, isn't it? It doesn't matter whether you look to Europe or the USA. The career of any political leader you like to mention will be characterized by this kind of parabola. A rise to election glory when expectations are raised to huge heights by this new incumbent, followed by meteoric descent. The people eventually always become disillusioned with them. And that utopian dream we invested in them when they were first appointed is always blown away. Why is that? Is it that we, the electorate, are just fickle in our affections, like sulky children unable to put up with anybody for long who wants to tell us what to do? Well, that may be part of the truth. But the larger factor, I think, has to be that politicians always let us down because, like us, they are human beings. They're fallible.
They're sinful. And therefore they are irremediably disappointing. Perfect government is a mirage which will always leave us empty, thirsty, the more we pursue it. We just don't have perfect people, you see, to construct that perfect government out of. Now, in many respects, this section of the Bible we're going to be studying for the next four Sundays, leading up to the general election, is a classic illustration of this sober political realism. 5 centuries before the golden age of Pericles, the newly emergent nation of Israel also, like Athens, had to define its political system. And as in the case of Athens, the will of the people was a crucial factor in that decision. Though the conclusion which the people came to was rather different, as you will see if you look back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." Up until this point in the history of Israel, Israel had been a fairly loose confederation of tribes administered by local clan chieftains, the elders mentioned here in verse 4. A national consciousness existed, of course, in Israel. They were all united by a common ancestor, Abraham, a common sense of history going back to the Exodus. But there was no well-developed machinery of state to give any expression to that sense of inter-tribal solidarity, not even a capital city. The nearest they got to a political symbol of national identity, national unity, were the judges. The judges were a group of men, a group of individuals, and actually some women too, like Deborah, who functioned both as military leaders and as judicial figures. When there was a need to raise the tribal muster against some hostile aggressor, it was the judges who did it. When there was a need to discriminate some kind of judicial issue between the tribes, maybe over territory or something, it was the judges who did it. But the distinctive things about these judges was that they were all charismatic figures. They sprang up without warning, and always with some clear evidence of divine anointing, like Gideon or Deborah or Samson. They had some special gift. And in between them, there were long gaps when there was no judge, and when Israel was in danger of descending into anarchy. But as I say, one way or another, that had been the pattern right up until this moment in 1 Samuel 8, verse 4, that we've just read about. But now, you see, change is in the air. Samuel is the last of the judges. A prophetic figure, and sometimes even rather a military figure, though he didn't actually wield a sword, he certainly led the Israelites in battle. But now the elders are coming to him and saying, "You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." This was revolutionary stuff. We don't want to be a tribal confederation anymore. We want to be a centralized monarchy. This was a constitutional change, every bit as radical as Cromwell's Commonwealth or Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. Why did they want a king? Well, we can detect several motives, can't we, in these verses? First of all, they wanted to secure leadership succession. "You're getting old, Samuel, and your sons don't have the same qualities you do. We need to appoint somebody now before you die so we don't get left with another of those gaps in our history." The second reason seems to have been a desire for military security. If you look down to verse 20, you'll see the people give away another motive that underlies that. "Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." If you read widely in this chapter, you'd realize that Israel at this time was facing a major military crisis. The Philistines, who had military technology superior to them, were threatening to completely engulf them. In part, this desire for a king to lead us is born out of that desire to find security in the face of this military threat, to fight our battles. But perhaps underlying even that, our narrator suggests that there's a third factor, doesn't he? What you might call nationalism. Then we will be like all the other nations. Appoint a king to lead us such as all the other nations have. In other words, what's really bugging perhaps these Israelites underneath, more than all the uncertainties of Samuel's succession or the immediate problem of military defense, was this rather humiliating sense they had of being behind the times, out of fashion, on the international scene. The Philistines had a king to lead them. The Amalekites had a king to lead them. The Ammonites had a king to lead them. All the surrounding Canaanite nations were monarchies. Why are we still running around like a bunch of uncivilized primitives? No wonder we're not making any progress. We need more centralization, more organization. In short, we need a king. Give us a personal focus for our collective pride and loyalty in the face of our rivals. Give us a national status symbol, Samuel. You've got to have a king these days to keep up with the Joneses. We want a king. Oh, here then is the will of the people. A populist demand, not, as we've become rather accustomed to in recent centuries, to displace a monarchy, but to establish a monarchy. One really wonders what Jefferson would have made of that. How does a Democrat view this unexpected state of affairs? Well, the will of the people is always right, of course, according to democracy. But when you look further down this chapter 1 Samuel 8, you realize that that was a sentiment which Samuel didn't entirely share. As far as he was concerned, it was by no means self-evident that the will of the people ought to be done in this matter. Look at verse 6. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. Now we have a problem at this point in the text, a problem which has always perplexed scholars. Why exactly was Samuel displeased? What was he unhappy about? For after all, the idea of a king, according to the book of Deuteronomy, was not a new one. According to the book of Deuteronomy, monarchy was in the constitution of Israel, waiting to be implemented. Moses had made provision for it. You can look it up in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14, if you want to. In fact, it may very well be that the people in coming to Samuel in this way are claiming a constitutional right, even echoing the words of Deuteronomy 17 when they say, "Give us a king like the other nations." It was a legitimate ambition. So was Samuel just being a bit peevish? Does his reluctance indicate some wounded ego? It's never nice to be told you're getting too old for the job, is it? Never nice to be told of the shortcomings of your children. Perhaps there's even the suspicion of sour grapes in his attitude. Do you see in verse 7 when God replies, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected as their king, but me." Does that suggest that Samuel's opinion in this matter was rather shaped by the thought that if anybody was going to be king in Israel, it ought to be him? Well, it's not difficult, is it, to find very natural explanations of his perhaps rather dog-in-the-manger attitude towards the leadership of the nation, even if there was no sense of personal pique involved. Older people tend to be rather conservative and reluctant to change at the best of times, don't they? And I guess if Samuel had been an ordinary old man, one would have had no difficulty writing his negative opinions off. It's just that kind of stubbornness. But the text of the Bible doesn't allow us that kind of psychological analysis. Tempting though it might be to interpret it that way, and many scholars have, and though it may contain some element of truth, for Samuel was a human being, not an angel, nevertheless, the text insists that God, too, was not totally euphoric about this idea of a king that the people were demanding. Look again at verse 7. "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected as their king, but me, as they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you." Why then this reluctance to appoint a king? Even God seems to be against it, and yet God had allowed it back in that book of Deuteronomy chapter 17. Well, the answer, I suggest to you, lies in this. It's not the idea of a king as such that Samuel is unhappy about. It's the particular kind of king that the people have in mind that disturbs him. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 17, you'll discover there that Moses lays down all kinds of provisions about this monarchy in the national constitution. The king, for instance, was not to acquire great numbers of horses. He could not have a standing army or a professional cavalry. He was to rely on the tribal muster, just as the judges had done when he had to deal with military threats. Also, he wasn't allowed to make the people, as the text says, return to Egypt. That is, he wasn't allowed to exchange the liberty of the nation for military security from some great pagan empire. He wasn't to enter into alliances anymore with pagan nations. He wasn't to take many wives. He wasn't to have a harem, as most ancient kings did. He wasn't to accumulate large amounts of silver and gold through taxation, as most monarchs did. In fact, Deuteronomy says, most astonishingly of all, he was to write for himself on a scroll a copy of the law, and it was to be with him to the end of his life, so that he may learn, says Deuteronomy, to revere the Lord and follow carefully all the words of his, that is God's, law, not turning from it to the right or to the left. That's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think about it? A king who's not allowed to make laws. A king who is there rather to enforce and to keep the law already given to him. It's an extraordinary picture, even more extraordinary in the context of Middle Eastern politics 1000 BC. Canaanite kings were tyrants, absolute dictators with totalitarian control of their realms. But the sort of king that Moses is describing in Deuteronomy 17 is hedged around with all kinds of limitations on his powers. He can't have an army, he can't have a treasury, he can't have a harem, he can't even pass laws. In fact, he comes very close to what we would call, from our modern point of view, a constitutional monarch. A monarch that is held in check, not by perhaps democratic control of the people, but by the overarching constitutional constraints of a higher law, the law of God. What Deuteronomy describes is not a government of men at all, but a government of law, God's law, of which the monarch is not the appointed architect, but the appointed trustee. Now, just compare that picture of constitutional monarchy, which Moses laid down in Deuteronomy 17, with the kind of picture that Samuel goes on in verses 11 to 18 to describe here as the kind of consequence that will follow from the appointment of a king as the people are asking for in his day. In verse 11, he tells them, "This king who will reign over you will do this. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses." What's that you say? I thought the king wasn't allowed to have horses and chariots. Oh, but the king you want will, won't he? "And he'll appoint your sons to his professional cavalry." Again, in verse 12, it will have economic consequences. "Others will plow his ground and reap his harvest. Still others will make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots." The economy of the country, he says, is going to be distorted by the demands of this monarchy. Its defense spending, its demand for labor. The king will feather his own nest out of the national wealth. And it will have political consequences too. Verse 17, "He will take a tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his slaves." There will be a loss of self-determination. In a word, the sort of king you're wanting will turn out to be a tyrant, he says. Verse 18, "And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day." That language, I think, quite deliberately echoes the bondage of the people in Egypt. This king had taken them back to Egypt. They had become oppressed again by another pharaoh. Only ironically, this time, it would be one they had chosen for themselves. The problem, you see, was that the kind of monarchy that they were looking for was monarchy on the Canaanite model. a king like the other nations around us. That was the picture in their mind. They hadn't really read Deuteronomy carefully to find out what sort of king God allowed them. They had looked around at the other nations, seen what kind of political system was proving successful, particularly militarily, and said, we must have the same. When Samuel points out exactly how far this kind of monarchy will depart from the kind of freedom guaranteed them in their national constitution in the Bible, what is their answer? Verses 19 and 20. The people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. And when Samuel heard that all the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, mark this, listen to them. Give them a king. Isn't that extraordinary? Here is a God who knows the people's idea of monarchy is astray, who knows the long-term consequences of their political aspirations will be disastrous, who recognizes that the kind of king they want to appoint amounts to a rejection of his divine authority over their nation. The replacement of the theocracy guaranteed in the law of God by a totalitarian monarchy. And yet who says to the prophet, listen to them. Give them a king. Listen to them. Give them a king. Here is a God, you see, who accomplishes his will, not by preventing our human mistakes, but by allowing them. Not by denying our human freedom, but by granting it. Here is a meek God, I suggest to you. A God who does not even model his own sovereign rule among his people on the totalitarian tyrants of the world. God had given Israel the finest framework of constitutional law any nation had ever had in the history of the world. But if she chose to ignore it and replace his gracious rule with this kind of absolutist human government, he would not stand in her way. He would let her learn her political lessons by painful experience. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. Your political leaders will let you down, Israel, says Samuel. I'm forewarning you now. And of course, the very first king, who was indeed appointed, amply proved the point. Saul. That man we were introduced to in our reading just now. When his story begins, you know, in chapter 9, immediately on, following on from chapter 8 we've just been reading, everything is going for Saul. We're told he's good-looking. We're told he comes from a wealthy family. We're told he was the obvious choice of leader for the nation. In the early days, everything goes well for him. He's anointed in chapter 10, verse 1, by Samuel himself. He's supernaturally equipped by the Holy Spirit in chapter 10, verse 11. He's enthusiastically acclaimed by the people in chapter 10, verse 24. In chapter 11, verse 6, he has an outstandingly successful maiden military campaign against Israel's enemies. In fact, in chapter 11, verse 14, if you just turn onto there, you'll find Saul arrives at the peak of his popularity, being formally crowned as king at Gilgal. All the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. He's at the peak, you see, of that parabola. Really, perhaps, in the history of man, has somebody risen from obscurity to fame in quite so short a time? Maybe the question that hovers in our mind is, well, why Saul? I mean, why him rather than anybody else? Was it his father's money? Was it his stunning good looks? What was it suggested to Samuel and indeed to God that this man, Saul, was the one to become the first Lord's anointed in Israel? Well, up to point, I suppose it may be impudent for us to try to analyze the reasons for God's choice in this matter. His choices are always wrapped up in inscrutable mystery. And yet, the sacred historian who's writing 1 Samuel, I think, doesn't leave us in total darkness about what it was appealed to God, what it was he wanted this man Saul to demonstrate. Again and again, not so much by direct statement as by subtle implication in the narrative, our author of 1 Samuel reveals to us the charming modesty of this young man, Saul. It comes out first, perhaps, in chapter 9, verse 21. Am I not a Benjaminite from the smallest tribe of Israel, and is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me? He says to Samuel, when Samuel suggests that he would be elevated in the nation. One could, I suppose, put that self-effacement down simply to good manners in the presence of an important man, but a similar spirit emerges again in chapter 10, verse 15. When he goes back to his uncle and tells his uncle what Samuel has done in anointing him, Samuel's uncle says, "Tell me what Samuel said to you." And Saul replied, "He assured us that the donkeys had been found, but he did not tell his uncle what Samuel had said about the kingship." See, it would have been very easy, wouldn't it, for Saul to boast proudly to his family about the high destiny which the prophet Samuel had announced to him. But with rather commendable reticence, he says nothing about it. 10:22 confirms us once again in this aspect of his early character. When Samuel calls the tribes together to select the king by lot, Saul cannot be found. We're told in verse 22 he was hidden among the baggage. And this continues to colour the responses of the early days of this man. Unlike some who can't bear to have their egos anything but massaged, Saul seems always to be waiting on God to lift him up. There's nothing pushy about him. Again in chapter 11, verses 12 to 13. The people say to Samuel, "Who was it that asked, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Bring these men to us and we will put them to death." An early indication of antagonism to Saul's reign here, in the very early days of his monarchy. But Saul says, "No one shall be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued Israel." Then you see, self-effacing and generous, even towards those whom many monarchs in his insecure early position would have taken rapid vengeance upon. There's this unpretentious humility about this man then, something unassuming, something almost bashful about him. You see it again and again and again. And in Saul's story, it seems to be the erosion of that early humility that leads to his downfall. Look, for instance, at chapter 13, verse 5. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Remember what we said about the military superiority of these formidable Philistines? They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. And when the men of Israel saw that their situation was critical and that their army was hard-pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw the men were scattering and the Jew did not come at the set time and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal and I have not sought the Lord's favor.' So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time." You can understand Saul's position in this situation. He's been on the throne now for quite a while. Maybe a decade or two, we don't know exactly how long. But he certainly has an heir apparent now, Prince Jonathan, who seems old enough to bear arms in battle. The monarchy then has been consolidated. The crown feels secure on his brow. And by this time, Solomon must be an extremely old man. No doubt, finding it rather more difficult to gallop around the countryside as he used to, I say one can sympathize with Saul's impatience in the situation. His soldiers are beginning to desert. Morale is collapsing before this Philistine threat. We've got to get on with the battle now. Further delay will mean a disastrous rout. I've waited a week for the old codger. After all, that's what he said. For all I know, he's had a heart attack on the road. What can possibly be the harm in my conducting the religious formalities myself? I am the king, after all, aren't I? But you see, what for Saul seemed a harmless exercise of his royal discretionary powers, Samuel perceived as a flagrant breach of Israel's theocratic constitution. Among those limitations on royal power that we mentioned laid down in the law of God was this. The king was not to usurp the role of prophet and priest. The king was there to administer the law of the land, but it was the priest who offered the sacrifices. The sword of temporal and spiritual power was separated in Israel's constitution, and they may not be combined. For once you see a king thought he had religious prerogatives too, he'd taken a huge step towards precisely that kind of tyranny which characterized the Canaanite monarchs. They were God kings in their countries. One gets the definite impression, however, that Saul wasn't convinced about that issue of constitutional law anymore. He was, in fact, getting rather ambitious. Verse 13, you have not kept the command the Lord gave you. Verse 14, your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart because you have not kept the Lord's command. For the first time here, you see, a shadow falls over the house of Saul. But the strange thing is that Saul himself is not greatly concerned about Samuel's threats. There is, in fact, a dawning contempt for God and his spokesman. It's not long before we find further evidence of him doing exactly what he has just done. 14, verse 35. Saul built an altar to the Lord, we read there. It was the first time he'd done this. And that, of course, is all prelude and overture to the chapter we read together at the very outset of our study, chapter 15. In 15 verses 1 to 3, it's as if Samuel sets Saul a final test. He reminds him, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. In other words, your appointment to the monarchy, Saul, does not proceed from the people or from your own gifts. It proceeds from God, who is the true sovereign of Israel, and I, as the prophet of that God, identified you. I was the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people, not your people, his people, Israel. So listen, Saul, to the message from the Lord. See how he's putting it on the line there for Saul. Who is the real sovereign in this country? You? Or the Lord Jehovah. What he's told to do, of course, is somewhat politically incorrect against the background of our 20th century sensitivities. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Go and attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Now, before we go waving our arms around in horror at the barbarism of this kind of warfare, just notice, will you, very carefully, that this is presented to us here in the text of the Bible as a judicial penalty carried out in the name of God and at his command. If we are offended at a God whose wrath against his enemies can pass such a savage verdict of destruction, whatever will we do when we hear his edict to cast sinners into hell? And the God of the Bible is a majestic God. As we were thinking at the very beginning of our service, he is a God to be feared because he comes in judgment among sinful men and women. And that judgment is a horrendous thing.
We do him no favors, diluting this passage of the Bible as if it was something to be embarrassed about. For those who are embarrassed by 1 Samuel 15 will be even more embarrassed by hell. That's the order, anyway. And Samuel insists it's an order which comes straight from the Lord. You have to get on with it, Saul. And notice what happens. Verse 7. Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive. All his people he totally destroyed with the sword, but Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and the lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. So you see, Saul's increasingly autocratic attitude leads him to commit the critical blunder. The command through Samuel had been explicit. Thus says the Lord. All of Samuel's prophetic authority as spokesman of Jehovah was implicit in those words. And Saul had now disregarded them as if they were merely the advice of a rather stupid old man. Agag is a king. A king like me, perhaps, he reasoned. We kings must stick together. If people get the idea you can kill kings, they might get the idea they can kill me. And what a waste to destroy all those herds. I mean, it's not as if they've got BSE, is it? Only a fool goes throwing money down the drain. So Saul rationalized. It's important to realize that in making this decision, he was not flouting the will of the people. That wasn't where his arrogance showed. I suspect that particularly with his army, this was a highly popular move. They were most interested in getting their hands on some of that plunder. Now, where Saul's arrogance displayed itself was in his refusal, in his contempt for God's word. It wasn't his failure to obey the will of the people, but his failure to obey the will of God, which was at the heart of his pride. The humility that had characterized him as a young man, you see, had been displaced. He, Saul, could offer sacrifices. Wasn't he the king? He, Saul, could command what he liked. Wasn't he the king? He, Saul, could spare whom he liked. Wasn't he the king? So the crown that sat on his head had gone to his head. Do you notice that little giveaway again in verse 12 of chapter 15? Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, Saul has gone to Carmel, a notable hill. There he has set up a monument in his own honor. And gone down to Gilgal. That was the sort of man Saul had become, you see. The sort of man who sets up monuments in his own honor. John Ruskin says, pride is at the bottom of all great mistakes. And I guess that has to be said as true. It was at the bottom of Adam's initial mistake, and it is still the sin that cuts human beings off from paradise more securely than any other. It's pride that has gripped Saul's heart here. He has forgotten that he was only what he was by the grace of God. And now God would prove it to him by removing that sustaining grace and forcing him to feel his native weakness and insufficiency all over again. Verse 17, Samuel said, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? Away with these excuses, he says. Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. Rebellion is like the sin of divination. Arrogance is like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. So Saul reaches the peak of his parabolic career, only like so many political leaders,
to begin just as rapid a decline. The remaining years of his life, though full of incident, are monotonic in their message. Here is a man now deserted by God, whose personality is disintegrating. In fact, one word hovers on our lips again and again as we read on from chapter 16. It's the word insanity. By the close of 1 Samuel, it's quite clear that this man Saul is little short of being a paranoid psychopath, obsessed with an insane jealousy. He has murdered the innocent. He has dabbled in the occult. The Bible itself describes him as demon-possessed. And when his end finally comes, predictably enough, as a suicide, we gain no satisfaction from it. We do not feel comfortably reassured that this satanic villain has at last reaped his due recompense. Though when we come to the end of the life of Saul, it is a profound pathos we feel. Like David, his successor, we mourn for Saul. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How are the mighty fallen? They say, truth is often stranger than fiction, don't they? And the story of Saul, in a way, proves it true, because here we have King Lear, here we have Macbeth, here we have Othello, all rolled into one real man. The noble man who becomes a lunatic, the hero who becomes a clown, the divine choice who becomes a lost soul. Saul does not make us angry. He makes us weep. Even as he made Samuel weep. You see what Samuel says? Verse 10, 11. I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. And Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. It could have been so different, you see. There's a pitifulness about the ruin of this man. Tragedy is almost too weak a term, because it isn't foul play or misfortune that destroys him. His downfall is self-inflicted. No ill wind shipwrecks him. It is ambition, overweening ambition, arrogance and pride that shapes his reckless course and drives him under the rocks. And so he stands in Scripture like an obelisk of warning to all who aspire to greatness in the world. What is it Solomon says? Pride goes before destruction. A haughty spirit before a fall. Solomon's proverb is almost Saul's epitaph. But then I guess pride is the occupational hazard of all who exercise the role of leader, isn't it? John Randolph, the early American politician, wrote, no man was ever content to be half a king. That was Saul's problem. He wasn't content to be half a king. Power, like a drug, intoxicates those who feed on it. It is the very rare leader who fails to have their mind clouded by delusions of grandeur in that heady atmosphere they must breathe at the top of the tree. Now, there's a warning here. A warning to all of us who aspire to leadership, and that, of course, includes me. It includes the other pastors and the elders, includes all within our fellowship of the church here. But it includes also those outside in the world there who are aspiring for political office over these next 4 weeks. Beware of pride. A crown only has to slip a few inches to become a noose. God will have no boasting in his kingdom. Remember Saul. But if it's a warning to those who aspire to leadership, isn't it also a warning to us, the electorate, the men and the women in the street, who call for leadership, who ask this man or that person to be their king? A French historian once said, every nation gets the government it deserves. So it's a salutary reminder, that, I think. We want a king. That's what the people told Samuel. Remember that. He was appointed by will of the people. God replied, all right, I'll give you the king. Exactly the kind of king you want. The kind of king that will make you clap. The kind of king that will lift your expectations. Before I give you the kind of king you really need, I'll give you the kind of king you want. The kind of king you deserve. In many ways, you see, the personal tragedy of Saul is simply a mirror to the national tragedy of Israel. If you think about it, the story of Saul and the story of Israel both begin with extraordinary opportunity. They are stories of divine election, divine privilege, divine blessing. And the stories of Saul and Israel both end in horrifying ruin. The kingdom is taken from you and given to another who will produce the fruit of it, Jesus said to the Jews of his day. That was Jesus' verdict on Israel in his parable of the vineyard, and it summarizes perfectly God's verdict upon Saul. The kingdom is taken from you and given to another who will produce the fruit of it. See what I mean? Saul is the king Israel deserved. He is a reflection of her national character. In his own person, he epitomizes that mysterious divine purpose that succeeds precisely where it seems to fail. That gives people the king they want and lets them reap the consequences. That lets them crucify the king they really need. And pays the price. Only a nation that had seen the tragedy of Saul might learn to appreciate the more godly virtues of David. And only a world that has proven by painful experience how habitually its leaders disappoint it might one day discover the real king who won't. Representative democracy is so vulnerable to disillusionment, you see. Our politicians will always disappoint us. Whoever gets appointed on May the 1st, pride will probably subvert his gifts. It will probably corrupt his motives. It will probably undermine his judgment. Don't expect too much from him, whoever he is. Whether he calls himself a king or a prime minister or a president, political leaders are bound to disappoint us. They are sinners. But no worse sinners than you and me. The reason they disappoint us, the reason leaders disappoint us, is because leaders hold up a mirror to our own moral failures and inadequacies. Don't expect too much from them, then. The best preparation you and I can make for May the 1st is to pray. Pray for those leaders. As Samuel prayed for Saul, for the prayers of the people of God are a far better defense of our national liberties than democracy ever will be.